voice was a strange mixture of a slightly Western drawl and the precise, clipped phraseology of an English accent. I might describe it as courtly. Shut off from the night outside, with doors locked to protect us from the occasional irrational caller who tried to break in, there was an insular feel to those two offices where we worked. The two of us were all alone in the building, connected to the outside world only by the phone lines. Beyond the walls, we could hear sirens screaming as police units and medic eye rigs raced up Pine Street a block away toward the county hospital. With the blackness outside our windows broken only by the lights in the harbor far below us, the sound of rain and sleet against the panes, those sirens seemed to be the only thing reminding us that there was a world of people out there. We were locked in a boiler room of other people's crises. I don't know why we became such close friends so rapidly. Perhaps it was because we dealt with so many life-and-death situations together, making our Tuesday nights intense situations that bound us together the way soldiers in battle often are. Perhaps it was the isolation, and the fact that we were constantly talking to other people about their most intimate problems. And so, when the quiet nights came, the nights when the moon was no longer full, when the welfare money had run out with no money left to buy liquor, and when the street people and the callers seemed to be enjoying a spate of serenity, Ted and I talked for hours to each other. On the surface, at least, it seemed that I had more problems than Ted did. He was one of those rare people who listen with full attention, who evince a genuine caring by their very stance. You could tell things to Ted that you might never tell anyone else. Most of the crisis clinic volunteers gave our time because we had endured crises ourselves, tragedies that made us more able to understand those who called in. I was not an exception. I had lost my only brother to suicide when he was 21, a Stanford senior about to enter Harvard Medical School. I had tried vainly to convince him that life was worthwhile and precious, and I had failed, because I'd been too close to him and had felt his pain too acutely. If I could save someone else, I think I felt that it might help me to expiate some of the guilt I still carried. Ted listened quietly as I told him about my brother, of the long night's wait while sheriff's deputies looked for Don, finally finding him too late in a deserted park north of Palo Alto, dead of carbon monoxide poisoning. In 1971, my life was not without problems. My marriage was in deep trouble, and I was again trying to cope with guilt. Bill and I had agreed to a divorce only weeks before he'd been diagnosed as having a malignant melanoma, the deadliest of skin cancers. "What can I do?" I asked Ted. "How can I leave a man who may be dying?"
"Are you sure he's dying?" Ted responded.
"No. The first surgery seems to have caught all the malignancy, and the skin grafts have finally held. He wants to end the marriage. He says he wants to, but I feel as if I'm really running away from a sick man who needs me."
"But it's his choice, isn't it? If he seems well, and if your being together is an unhappy situation for both of you, then you have no guilt. He's made the decision. It's his life, and especially when he might not have that many years ahead, it's his right to decide how he wants to spend them."
"Are you talking to me as if I were a crisis caller?" I smiled.
"Maybe. Probably. But my feelings would be the same. You both deserve to get on with your lives."
Ted's advice proved to be the right advice. Within a year, I would be divorced, and Bill would remarry, would have 4 good years doing what he wanted. What was happening in my life in 1971 is unimportant to the story of Ted Bundy, save for the fact that Ted's incisive viewpoint on my problems, his unfailing support and belief in my capabilities as a writer who could earn a living on her own, demonstrate the kind of man I knew. It was that man I would continue to believe in for many years. Because I had opened up my life to him, Ted seemed to feel at ease in talking about the vulnerable areas in his world, although it was not until many weeks after I met him that he did so. One night, he moved his chair through the alcove that separated our desks and sat beside me. Behind him, one of the posters that were plastered over most of the walls in our offices was in my direct line of vision. It was a picture of a howling kitten clinging to a thick rope,
and it read, "When you get to the end of your rope, tie a knot and hang on." Ted sat there silently for a moment or two as we sipped coffee companionably. Then he looked down at his hands and said,
"You know, I only found out who I really am a year or so ago. I mean, I always knew, but I had to prove it to myself."
I looked at him a little surprised and waited for the rest of the story.
"I'm illegitimate. When I was born, my mother couldn't say that I was her baby. I was born in a home for unwed mothers, and when she took me home, she and my grandparents decided to tell everyone that I was her brother and that they were my parents. So I grew up believing that she was my sister, that I was a late baby born to my grandparents."
He paused and looked at the sheets of rain that washed over the windows in front of us. I didn't say anything. I could tell he had more to say.
"I knew. Don't tell me how I knew. Maybe I heard conversations. Maybe I just figured out that there couldn't be 20 years difference in age between a brother and a sister, and Louise always took care of me. I just grew up knowing that she was really my mother."
"Did you ever say anything?" He shook his head.
"No, it would have hurt them. It just wasn't something you talked about. When I was little, we moved away, Louise and I, and left my grandparents behind. If they were my mother and father, we wouldn't have done that. I went back east in 1969. I needed to prove it to myself, to know for sure. I traced my birth to Vermont, and I went to the city hall and I looked at the records. It wasn't difficult. I just asked for my birth certificate under my mother's name. And there it was."
"How did you feel? Were you shocked or upset?"
"No. I think I felt better. It wasn't a surprise at all. It was like I had to know the truth before I could do anything else. And when I saw it there on the birth certificate, then I'd done that. I wasn't a kid. I was 22 when I found out for certain."
"They lied to you. Did it seem like they deceived you?"
"No. I don't know."
"People lie out of love too, you know," I said. "Your mother could have let you go, but she didn't. She did the best she could. It must have seemed the only thing she could do to keep you with her. She must have loved you very much." He nodded and said softly,
"I know. I know."
"And look at you now. You turned out pretty good. In fact, you turned out great." He looked up and smiled.
"I hope so."
"I know so." We never talked about it again. It was funny. In 1946, when Ted's mother had found out she was pregnant in Philadelphia, I had been a high school student 30 miles away in Coatesville. I remember that when the girl who sat next to me in physics class became pregnant, it was the talk of the school. That's the way things were in 1946. Could Ted understand that in 1971? Could he even fathom what his mother had gone through to keep him? He certainly seemed to have made the most of his considerable assets. He was brilliant, and making almost straight A's in psychology in his senior year, even though most of his studying had to be done between calls during his all-night shifts at the crisis clinic. I had never brought up any facet of psychology that Ted wasn't fully conversant with. During that autumn quarter of 1971, Ted was taking ecological biology, adaptation of man, laboratory of human performance, and an honors seminar. He was handsome, although the years of adversity ahead would somehow see him become even handsomer, as if his features were being honed to a fine edge. And Ted was physically strong, much stronger than I had thought when I saw him for the first time. He had seemed slender, almost frail, and I had made it a habit to bring cookies and sandwiches to share with him each Tuesday night. I thought he might not be getting enough to eat. I was surprised one warm night when he'd bicycled to the clinic wearing cut-off blue jeans. His legs were as thickly muscled and powerful as a professional athlete's. He was slender, but he was whipcord tough. As far as his appeal for women, I can remember thinking that if I were younger and single, or if my daughters were older, this would be almost the perfect man. Ted talked quite a bit about Meg and Leanne. I assumed that he was living with Meg, although he never actually said he was.
"She's really interested in your work," he said one night.
Could you bring in some of your detective magazines so I can take them home to her?
I did bring in several, and he took them with him. He never commented on them, and I assumed that he hadn't read them. We were talking one night about his plans to go to law school. It was almost spring then, and for the first time, he told me about Stephanie.
I love Meg, and she really loves me, he began. She's helped me with money for school. I owe her a lot. I don't want to hurt her, but there's somebody else I can't stop thinking about.
Again, he had surprised me. He'd never mentioned anyone but Meg.
Her name is Stephanie, and I haven't seen her for a long time. She's living near San Francisco, and she's completely beautiful. She's tall, almost as tall as I am, and her parents are wealthy. She's never known anything but being rich. I just couldn't fit in with that world.
Are you in touch with her at all? I asked.
Once in a while. We talk on the phone. Every time I hear her voice, it all comes back. I can't settle for anything else unless I try one more time. I'm going to apply for law school any place I can get in around San Francisco. I think the problem now is that we're just too far apart. If we were both in California, I think we could get back together.
I asked him how long it had been since he'd gone with Stephanie, and he said they'd broken up in 1968, but that Stephanie was still single.
Do you think she might love me again if I sent her a dozen red roses?
It was such a naive question that I looked up to see if he was serious.
He was.
When he talked about Stephanie in the spring of 1972, it was as if the intervening years hadn't happened at all.
I don't know, Ted, I ventured. If she feels the same way you do, the roses might help, but they wouldn't make her love you if she's changed. She's the one woman, the only woman I ever really loved. It's different from the way I feel about Meg. It's hard to explain. I don't know what to do.
Seeing the glow in his eyes when he talked about Stephanie, I could envision the heartbreak ahead for Meg. I urged him not to make promises to Meg he couldn't keep. At some point, you're going to have to choose. Meg loves you. She stood by you when the going is rough, when you don't have any money. You say that Stephanie's family makes you feel poor, as if you don't fit in. It might be that Meg's real and Stephanie's a dream. I guess the real test is, how would you feel if you didn't have Meg? What would you do if you knew she had someone else, if you found her with another man?
I did once. It's funny you should bring it up, because it just made me wild. We'd had a fight, and I saw some guy's car parked outside her apartment. I raced around the alley and stood up on a garbage can to look in the window. The sweat was just pouring off me, and I was like a crazy man. I couldn't stand to think of Meg with another man. I couldn't believe the effect it had on me.
He shook his head, bemused by the violence of his jealousy. Then maybe you care more about Meg than you realize.
That's the problem. One day I think I want to stay here, marry Meg, help bring Leanne up, have more children. That's what Meg wants. Sometimes it seems like that's all I want. But I don't have any money. I won't have any money for a long time. And I can't see myself being tied down to a life like that just when I'm getting started. And then I think about Stephanie and the life I could have with her. I want that, too. I've never been rich, and I want to be. But how can I say thanks a lot and goodbye to Meg?
The phones rang then, and we left the problem in midair. Ted's turmoil didn't seem that bizarre or desperate for a man of 24. In fact, it seemed quite normal. He had some maturing to do. When he did, I thought he would probably make the right decision. When I arrived for work a few Tuesdays later, Ted told me he had applied for admittance to law school at Stanford and at the University of California at Berkeley. Ted seemed to be a prime candidate for law school. He had the incisive mind for it, the tenacity, and he believed totally in the orderly progression of changes in the system of government through legislation. His stance made him something of a loner among the work-study students working at the crisis clinic. They were semi-hippies, both in their garb and their political views, and he was a conservative Republican. I could see that they considered him a rather odd duck as they argued about the riots that were constantly erupting on the university campus.
You're wrong, man, a bearded student told him. You aren't going to change Vietnam by sucking up to the old fogies in Congress. All they care about is another big contract for Boeing. You think they give a shit about how many of us get killed?
Anarchy isn't going to solve anything. You just end up scattering your forces and getting your head broken, Ted responded.
They snorted in derision. He was anathema to them.
The student riots and the marches blocking the I-5 freeway enraged Ted. On more than one occasion, he had tried to block the demonstrations, waving a club and telling the rioters to go home. He believed there was a better way to do it, but his own anger was, strangely, as intense as those he tried to stop.
I never saw that anger. I never saw any anger at all. I cannot remember everything that Ted and I talked about, try as I might, but I do know we never argued.
Ted's treatment of me was the kind of old-world gallantry that he invariably showed toward any woman I ever saw him with, and I found it appealing. He always insisted on seeing me safely to my car when my shift at the crisis clinic was over in the wee hours of the morning. He stood by until I was safely inside my car, doors locked and engines started, waving to me as I headed for home 20 miles away. He often told me,
"Be careful. I don't want anything to happen to you."
Compared to my old friends, the Seattle homicide detectives, who routinely saw me leave their offices after a night's interviewing at midnight in downtown Seattle with a laughing, "Well, watch out the window, and if anyone mugs you, we'll call 911, Ted was like a knight in shining armor. Chapter 5. I had to drop my volunteer work at the crisis clinic in the spring of 1972. I was writing 6 days a week. And beyond that, I was getting stale, a little jaded on the phones. After a year and a half, I had heard the same problems too many times. I had problems of my own. My husband had moved out, we had filed for divorce, and I had 2 teenagers and 2 preteens at home who provided their own crises for me to cope with. Ted graduated from the university in June. We had never seen each other outside the crisis clinic, and now we kept in touch with infrequent phone calls. I didn't see him again until December. My divorce was final on December 14th. On December 16th, all current and former clinic personnel were invited to a Christmas party at Bruce Cummins's home on Lake Washington. I had a car, but no escort, and I knew Ted didn't have a car, so I called and asked him if he would like to attend the party with me. He seemed pleased, and I picked him up at the Rogers' rooming house on 12th NE. Frieda Rogers smiled at me and called up the stairs to Ted. On the long drive from the university district to the South End, we talked about what had happened in the intervening months since we'd seen each other. Ted had spent the summer working as an intern in psychiatric counseling at Harborview, the huge county hospital complex. As a policewoman in the 1950s, I had taken a number of mentally deranged subjects, 220s in police lingo, to the 5th floor of Harborview, and knew the facilities there well. But Ted talked little about his summer job. He was far more enthusiastic about his activities during the governor's campaign in the fall of 1972. He had been hired by the Committee to Re-elect Dan Evans, Washington's Republican governor. Former Governor Albert Rossellini had made a comeback try, and it had been Ted's assignment to travel around the state and monitor Rossellini's speeches, taping them for analysis by Evans's team.
"I just mingled with the crowds and nobody knew who I was," he explained.
He'd enjoyed the masquerade, sometimes wearing a false mustache, sometimes looking like the college student he'd been only a short time before. And he'd been amused at the way Rossellini modified his speeches easily for the wheat farmers of eastern Washington and the apple growers of Wenatchee. Rossellini was a consummate politician, the opposite of the upfront all-American Evans. All this was heady stuff for Ted, to be on the inside of a statewide campaign, to report to Governor Evans himself and his top aides with the tapes of Rossellini's speeches. On September 2nd, Ted, driving Governor Evans and other dignitaries in the lead limousine, had been the first man to traverse the North Cascades Highway that winds through spectacular scenery at the northern boundaries of Washington State.
"They thought that President Nixon was going to show up," Ted recalled, "and they had Secret Service men checking everybody out. His brother came instead, but I didn't care. I got to lead 15,000 people in a 64-mile parade across the mountains."
The Evans campaign for re-election had been successful, and now Ted was in good standing with the administration in power. At the time of the Christmas party, he was employed by the City of Seattle's Crime Prevention Advisory Commission and was reviewing the state's new hitchhiking law, a law which made thumbing a ride legal again. "Put me down as being absolutely against hitchhiking," I said. "I've written too many stories about female homicide victims who met their killers while they were hitchhiking." Although Ted still looked forward to law school, he had his sights on the position as director of the Crime Prevention Advisory Commission, was among the final candidates, and felt optimistic about getting the job. We went our separate ways at the party. I danced with Ted once or twice, and noticed that he seemed to be having a good time talking with several women. He seemed to be completely entranced with a young woman who belonged to Seattle's Junior League, a crisis clinic volunteer whom neither of us had happened to meet before. Since some shifts never coincided, it wasn't unusual that volunteers' paths didn't cross. The woman was married to a young lawyer with a future, a man who is now one of Seattle's most successful attorneys. Ted didn't talk to her. In fact, he seemed in awe of her, but he pointed her out to me and asked about her. She was a beautiful woman with long dark hair, straight and parted in the middle, and dressed in a way that spoke of money and taste. She wore a black long-sleeve blouse, a straight white silk evening skirt, solid gold chains and earrings. I doubt that she was even aware of Ted's fascination with her, but I caught him staring at her several times during the evening. With the others at the party, he was expansive, relaxed, and usually the center of conversation. Since I was the driver, Ted drank a good deal during the evening, and he was quite intoxicated when we left at 2 a.m. He was a friendly, relaxed drunk, and he settled into the passenger seat and rambled on and on about the woman at the party who had impressed him so much.
"She's just what I've always wanted. She's perfect, but she didn't even notice me."
And then he fell sound asleep. When I delivered Ted back to the Rogerses that night, he was almost comatose, and it took me 10 minutes of shaking him and shouting to wake him up. I walked him to the door and said goodnight, smiling as he bumbled in the door and disappeared. A week later, I received a Christmas card from Ted. The block print read, "O. Henry wrote The Gift of the Magi, a story of two lovers who sacrifice for each other their greatest treasures. She cut her long hair to buy her lover a watch chain. He sold his watch to buy her combs for her hair. In acts that might seem foolish, these two people found the spirit of the Magi." It was my favorite Christmas story. How had he known? Inside, Ted printed his own wishes. "The new year should be a good one for a talented, delightful, newly liberated woman. Thank you for the party. Love, Ted." I was touched by the gesture. It was typical of Ted Bundy. He knew I needed the emotional support of these sentiments. Seemingly, there wasn't a thing in the world I could do for him. He wasn't interested in me romantically. I was just about as poor as he was, hardly influential. He sent that card simply because we were friends. When I look at that card today and compare it with the signatures on the dozens of letters I would receive later, I am struck with the difference. Never again would he sign with the jaunty flourish he did then. Ted didn't get the job as director of the Crime Prevention Advisory Commission, and he resigned in January 1973. I saw him again on a rainy day in March. An old friend whom I'd known since my days on the police department, Joyce Johnson, a detective for 11 years in the sex crimes unit, and I emerged from the police jail elevator in the public safety building on our way to lunch, and there was Ted. Bearded now, he looked so different that I didn't recognize him at first. He called my name and grabbed my hand. I introduced him to Joyce, and he told me enthusiastically that he was working for King County Law and Justice Planning Office.
"I'm doing a study on rape victims," he explained. "If you could get me some back copies of the stories you've done on rape cases, it would help my research."
I promised to go through my files and cull some of the accounts, many of them written about cases in which Joyce Johnson had been the principal detective, and get them to him. But somehow I never got around to it, and I eventually forgot that he'd wanted them. Ted had applied for the second time to the University of Utah's law school, largely at Meg's urging. Her father was a wealthy physician, her siblings professionals in Utah, and she hoped that she and Ted would eventually end up in the Mormon state. He was quickly accepted, although he had been rejected in a previous application to the University of Utah in 1972, despite his degree from the University of Washington with distinction. Ted's grade point average from the university was 3.51, a GPA that any student might have aspired to, but his legal aptitude test scores had not been high enough to meet Utah's standards for entry. In 1973, he bombarded the admissions department at Utah with letters of recommendation from professors and from Governor Dan Evans. Not content with the restrictions of a standard application form, he had resumes printed up listing his accomplishments since graduation from the University of Washington and wrote a 6-page personal statement on his philosophies on law. It made an impressive packet. Under postgraduate employment, Ted listed Criminal Corrections Consultant, January 1973, currently retained by the King County Office of Law and Justice Planning to identify recidivism rates for offenders who have been found guilty of misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors in the 12 county district courts. The purpose of the study is to determine the nature and number of offenses committed subsequent to a conviction in district court. Crime Commission Assistant Director, October 1972 to January 1973. As assistant to the director of the Seattle Crime Prevention Commission, suggested and did the preliminary investigation for the commission's investigations into assaults against women and white-collar economic crime. Wrote press releases, speeches, and newspaper articles for the commission. Participated extensively in the planning of the commission's activities for 1973. Psychiatric Counselor, June 1972 to September 1972. Carried a full caseload of 12 clients during a 4-month internship at Harborview Hospital's outpatient clinic. Held periodic sessions with clients. Entered progress reports in hospital charts. Continually reevaluated psychiatric diagnoses. And referred clients to physicians for medical and psychotherapeutic medication evaluations. Participated in numerous training sessions conducted by staff psychiatrists. Ted went on. I apply to law school because my professional and community activities demand daily a knowledge of the law I do not have. Whether I am studying the behavior of criminal offenders, examining bills before the legislature, advocating court reform, or contemplating the creation of my own corporation, I immediately become conscious of my limited understanding of the law. My lifestyle requires that I obtain a knowledge of the law and the ability to practice legal skills. I intend to be my own man. It's that simple. I could go on at great length to explain that the practice of law is a lifelong goal, or that I do not have great expectations that a law degree is a guarantee of wealth and prestige. The important factor, however, is that law fulfills a functional need which my daily routine has forced me to recognize. I apply to law school because this institution will give me the tools to become a more effective actor in the social role I have defined for myself. TRB. Ted's personal statement was most erudite and filled with quotes from experts ranging from Freud to the President's Committee on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice report. He began with a discussion of violence. You begin with the relation between might and right, and this is the assuredly proper starting point for our inquiry. But for the term might, I would substitute a tougher and more telling word, violence. In right and violence, we have today an obvious antinomy. He had not softened his position against riots, student insurrections, and anarchy. The law was right. The rest was violence. Ted stated his current involvement in a series of studies of jury trials. Using computer-coded data collected on 11,000 felony cases by the Washington State Criminal Justice Evaluation Project, I am writing programs designed to isolate what I hope to be tentative answers to questions regarding the management of felony cases. He talked of a study he had undertaken to equate the racial composition of a jury with its effect on the defendant.
Ted's thoroughly impressive application to the University of Utah Law School in early 1973 worked and overshadowed his mediocre law school aptitude test scores. But oddly, he chose not to enter their law school in the fall of 1973, and the reason given to the Dean of Admissions was a curious lie. He wrote with sincere regret, a week before classes were to begin, that he had been injured severely in an automobile accident and was hospitalized. He explained that he had hoped that he would be physically strong enough to attend the fall quarter, but found he was not able to, apologizing for waiting so long to let the university know, and saying he hoped that they could find someone to fill his place. In truth, Ted had been in an extremely minor accident, spraining his ankle, had not been hospitalized, and was in perfect condition. He had, however, wrecked Meg's car. Why he chose not to go to Utah in 1973 remains a mystery. There were discrepancies, too, in his almost flamboyant dossier. Both the study on rape that he told me he was writing and the racial significance and jury composition study were only ideas. He had not actively begun work on either. Ted did begin law school in the fall of 1973 at the University of Puget Sound in his hometown, Tacoma. He attended night classes on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, riding from the Rogers' rooming house to UPS, 26 miles south, in a carpool with three other students. After the night classes, he often stopped for a few beers with his carpool members at the Creekwater Tavern. Ted may have elected to remain in Washington because he had been awarded a plum political job in April 1973 as assistant to Ross Davis, chairman of the Washington State Republican Party. His $1,000 a month salary was more money than he'd ever made. The perks that came with the job were something that a man who had struggled for money and recognition most of his life could revel in. The use of a select credit card issued to the Republican Party, attendance at meetings with the big boys, and occasional use of a flashy car. There was statewide travel with all expenses paid. Davis and his wife thought highly of Ted. He ate dinner with their family at least once a week, and often babysat for their children. Davis recalls Ted as smart, aggressive, exceptionally so, and a believer in the system. Despite his work for the Republican Party, Ted managed to keep up a good grade point average in his night law classes at UPS. He continued to live at Frieda and Ernst Rogers' home in the University District in Seattle. Ernst's health was no better, and when he had free time, Ted helped to keep the house in repair. There had been great upheavals in Ted's life during 1973, but I had seen him only once during that year, the brief meeting in the public safety building in March. It was that kind of friendship where you touch base with someone rarely, you are pleased to see each other, and they are, at least on the surface, the same people you have always known. I saw Ted again in December of 1973. Again at a crisis clinic Christmas party. It was held at a board member's house in the Laurelhurst section in Seattle's North End, and this time Ted brought Meg Anders with him, and I met her for the first time. In one of those crystalline flashes that float to the surface of memory, I can recall standing in the host's kitchen, talking to Ted and Meg. Someone had placed a giant bowl of fried chicken wings on the counter, and Ted munched on them as we talked. Ted had never described Meg to me. I had heard his detailed recollection of Stephanie Brooks's beauty, and I had seen his reaction to the tall, dark-haired woman at last year's party. Meg was nothing like either of them. She seemed very small, very vulnerable, and her long, light brown hair overpowered her facial features. Clearly she adored Ted, and she clung to him, too shy to mingle. I commented that Ted and I had attended the last Crisis Clinic Christmas party together, and her face lit up.
Really? It was you?
I nodded. I didn't have a date, and Ted didn't have a car, so we decided to pool our resources. Meg seemed vastly relieved. I was clearly no threat to her, a nice middle-aged lady with a bunch of kids. I wondered then why he had let her agonize over it for a whole year when he could easily have explained our friendship to her. I spent most of that evening talking with Meg because she seemed so intimidated by the mass of strangers milling around us. She was very intelligent and very nice, but her focus of attention was Ted.
When he wandered off into the crowd, her eyes followed him. She was trying very hard to be casual, but for her, there was no one else there at all. I could understand her feelings only too well. 3 months before, I had fallen in love with a man who wasn't free, would never be free, and I could empathize with Meg's insecurity. Still, Ted had been with her for 4 years, and he seemed devoted to her and to Leanne. There seemed a good possibility that they might marry one day. Seeing Meg and Ted together, I assumed that he had given up his fantasy about Stephanie. I could not have been more wrong. Neither Meg nor I knew that Ted had just spent several days with Stephanie Brooks, that he was, in fact, engaged to Stephanie, and that he was looking forward to seeing her again within a week. Ted's life was so carefully compartmentalized that he was able to be one person with one woman and an entirely different man with another. He moved in many circles, and most of his friends and associates knew nothing of the other areas of his life. When I said goodbye to Ted and Meg in December 1973, I truly didn't expect to see him again. Our bond had been through the crisis clinic, and we were both moving away from that group. I had no way of knowing that Ted Bundy would one day change my life profoundly. It would be almost 2 years before I heard from Ted again, and when I did, it would be under circumstances that would shock me more than anything ever has. Or possibly ever will again. Chapter 6. Most of us have harbored a fantasy wherein we return to confront a lost first love, and in that reunion we have become better looking, thinner, richer, utterly desirable, so desirable that our lost love realizes instantly that he has made a terrible mistake. It seldom occurs in real life, but it is a fantasy that helps to relieve the pain of rejection. Ted had tried once in 1969 to reach out to Stephanie Brooks, to rekindle a seemingly extinguished flame, and it hadn't worked. But by the late summer of 1973, Ted Bundy had begun to be somebody. He had worked, planned, groomed himself to be the kind of man that he thought Stephanie wanted. Although his relationship with Meg Anders had been a steady and, to Meg, a committed one for 4 years, Ted had had no one but Stephanie on his mind when he arrived in Sacramento on a business trip for the Washington Republican Party. He contacted Stephanie in San Francisco, and she was amazed at the changes 4 years had wrought in him. Where he had been a boy, uncertain and wavering, with no foreseeable prospects, he was now urbane, smooth, and confident. He was nearing 27, and he seemed to have become an imposing figure in political circles in Washington State. When they went out to dinner, she marveled at his new maturity, the deft manner with which he dealt with the waiter. It was a memorable evening, and when it was over, Stephanie agreed readily to make a trip soon to Seattle to visit him, to talk about what the future might hold for them. He did not mention Meg. He seemed as free to make a commitment as Stephanie was. Stephanie had flown to Seattle during her vacation in September, and Ted met her at the airport, driving Ross Davis's car, and whisked her to the University Towers Hotel. He took her to dinner at the Davis's home. The Davises seemed to approve heartily of her, and she didn't demur when Ted introduced her as his fiancée. Ted had arranged for a weekend in a condominium at Alpental on Snoqualmie Pass, and still using Davis's car, he drove them up to the Cascade Pass, up through the same mountain foothills they'd traversed when they'd gone on skiing trips in their college days. Looking at the luxurious accommodations, she wondered how he had paid for it, but he explained that the condo belonged to a friend of a friend. It was an idyllic time. Ted was talking marriage seriously, and Stephanie was listening. She had fallen in love with him. A love that was much stronger than the feeling she'd had for him in their college romance. She was confident that they would be married within the year. She would work to pay his way through law school. Back at the Davis's home, Stephanie and Ted posed for a picture together, smiling, their arms around each other. And then Mrs. Davis drove her to the airport for the flight to San Francisco, as Ted had an important political meeting to attend. Stephanie flew back to Seattle in December 1973 and spent a few days with Ted in the apartment of a lawyer friend of his who was in Hawaii. Then she went further north to Vancouver, BC, to spend Christmas with friends. She was very happy. They would be together again for several days after Christmas, and she was sure they could firm up their wedding plans then. Ted, then, even as he introduced me to Meg at that Christmas party in 1973, had apparently been marking time until Stephanie returned. During those last days of 1973, Ted wined and dined Stephanie royally. He took her to Tai Tung's, the Chinese restaurant in the International District where they had eaten during their first courtship. He also took her to Ruby Chow's, a posh Oriental restaurant run by a Seattle City Councilwoman, telling her that Ruby was a good friend of his. But something had changed. Ted was evasive about marriage plans. He told her that he'd become involved with another woman, a woman who had had an abortion because of him.
"That's over, but she calls every so often, and I just don't think it's going to work out for us."
Stephanie was stunned. Ted told her he was trying to get loose of this other girl, a girl whose name he never mentioned, but that things were just too complicated. Where he had been so loving and affectionate, he now seemed cold and distant. They had such a little time to spend together, and yet he left her alone for an entire day while he worked on a project at school that she felt sure could have waited. He didn't buy her anything at all for Christmas, although he showed her an expensive chess set that he'd bought for his lawyer friend. She had brought him an expensive Indian print and a bow tie, but he showed little enthusiasm for her gifts. His lovemaking, which had been ardent, had become perfunctory, what she termed a Mr. Cool performance, rather than a spontaneous show of passion. In fact, she felt he was no longer attracted to her at all. Stephanie wanted to talk about it, to talk about their plans, but Ted's conversation was a bitter diatribe about his family. He talked about his illegitimacy, stressing over and over that Johnny Bundy wasn't his father, wasn't very bright, and didn't make much money. He seemed angry at his mother because she had never talked to him about his real father. He was scornful of what he called the lack of IQ of the whole Bundy clan. The only member of the extended family that he seemed to care about was his grandfather Cowell, but the old man was dead, leaving Ted with no one. Something had happened to change Ted's whole attitude toward her, and Stephanie was a very confused and upset woman when she flew back to California on January 2, 1974. Ted had not even made love to her on their last night together. He had chased after her for 6 years. Now he seemed uninterested, almost hostile. She had thought they were engaged, and yet he had acted as if he could hardly wait to be rid of her. Back in California, she waited for a call or a letter from him, something that might explain his radical change of heart. But there was nothing. Finally, she went to a counselor to try to sort out her own feelings.
"I don't think he loves me. It seems as though he just stopped loving me."
The counselor suggested that she write to Ted, and she did, saying that she had questions that had to be answered. Ted didn't answer that letter. In mid-February, Stephanie called Ted. She was angry and hurt, and she started to yell at him for dropping her without so much as an explanation. His voice was flat, calm, as he said,
"Stephanie, I have no idea what you mean."
Stephanie heard the phone click, and the line went dead. At length, she concluded that Ted's high-power courtship in the latter part of 1973 had been deliberately planned, that he had waited all those years to be in a position where he could make her fall in love with him, just so that he could drop her, reject her, as she had rejected him. In September 1974, she wrote to a friend,
"I don't know what happened. He changed so completely. I escaped by the skin of my teeth. When I think of his cold and calculating manner, I shudder."
She was never to have an explanation. She never heard from him again, and she married someone else at Christmas 1974. Chapter 7. During December 1973, I had participated in a different kind of writing project. I carried many deputy sheriff commissions in my wallet. They had been given to me by various counties around Washington State as a PR gesture, and made me more of a Kentucky colonel than a bona fide law officer. I'll admit I got a kick out of having the badges, but I didn't do any real law enforcement work. Then on Thursday, December 13th, I had been asked to help with an investigation in Thurston County, 60 miles south of Seattle. Sheriff Don Redman called and asked if I would attend a briefing on a homicide case his county was investigating.
"What we want to do, Anne," he explained, "is fill you in on where we are with the Devine case, get your impressions. Then we need a comprehensive narrative of everything we've got so far. It may be rushing you, but we'd like about 30 pages covering the case that we can hand to the prosecuting attorney on Monday morning. Could you do that?"
I drove to Olympia the next day and met with Sheriff Redmond, Chief Criminal Deputy Dwight Carone, and Detective Sergeant Paul Barclift. We spent the day going over follow-up reports, looking at slides, and reading the medical examiner's autopsy reports in the case involving the murder of 15-year-old Catherine Mary Devine. Kathy Devine had vanished from a street corner in Seattle's North End on November 25th. The pretty teenager, who had looked closer to 18 than 15, had last been seen alive hitchhiking. She had told friends that she was running away to Oregon. They had seen her, in fact, get into a pickup truck with a male driver. She had waved goodbye, and then she had disappeared. She never arrived at her Oregon destination. On December 6th, a couple hired to clean up litter in McKinney Park near Olympia had found Kathy's body. She lay on her face in the sodden forest. She was fully clothed, but her jeans had been slit in the back seam with a sharp instrument from her waist to the crotch. Decomposition was far advanced due to an unusually warm winter, and ravaging animals had carried away her heart, lungs, and liver. The pathologist's tentative conclusion was that she had been strangled, perhaps had her throat cut. The primary wounds had been to the neck. The condition of her clothing suggested also that she had been sodomized. She had been dead since shortly after she was last seen. Sheriff Redman and his investigators were left with the girl's body, the mock suede coat with fur trim, the blue jeans, a white peasant blouse, waffle stomper boots, and some cheap costume jewelry. The time lapse between her disappearance and the discovery of her body made it next to impossible to get a handle on the man who had killed her.
"It's that damn new hitchhiking law," Redman said. "Kids can stick their thumbs out and get in a car with anybody."
There was so little to go on, but I took copious notes and spent the weekend putting the Devine case in chronological order, listing what was known and concluding that Kathy Devine had probably been killed by the man who gave her the ride. It seemed an isolated case. I had not written up any similar homicides in several years. I spent that whole weekend, with the exception of Saturday night when I attended the crisis clinic party, working on my 30-page report for Redmond. On Sunday evening, two deputies were sent up from Olympia to pick it up. As a special deputy on assignment, I was paid $100 from the department's investigative funds. I didn't forget the Devine case. A few months later, I wrote it up as an unsolved case for True Detective, asking that anyone with information contact the Thurston County Sheriff's Office. But no one did, and the case remained unsolved. With the new year, 1974, I was aware that if I was going to support four children, I would have to step up my writing sales. Although their father's cancer had seemingly been arrested, I remembered the first surgeon's prognosis that Bill's life expectancy could range anywhere from 6 months to 5 years. Most of my cases came from the Seattle Police and the King County Police Homicide Units. Those detectives were exceptionally kind to me, allowing me to interview them when crime in Seattle was at a low ebb. Far from being the tough, hard-bitten detectives depicted on television and in fiction, I found them to be highly sensitive men, men who understood that if I didn't find enough cases to write up, my kids might not eat. I formed some of the strongest friendships of my life with those men. For my part, I never burned them, never took anything off the record and used it in a story. I waited until trials were ended or until a defendant had pleaded guilty, careful that my reporting would in no way prejudice a prospective jury before trial. They trusted me, and I trusted them.
Because they knew I was trying to learn everything I could in the field of homicide investigations, I was often invited to attend seminars given by experts in law enforcement, and once, a 2-week homicide crime scene course given as part of the King County Police Basic Police School. I rode shifts with the Washington State Patrol, the K-9 units, Seattle Police, and King County Patrol units, Medic Eye paramedics, and spent 250 hours with Marshal 5, the Seattle Fire Department's arson team. I suppose it was an odd career for a woman, but I enjoyed it thoroughly. Half the time I was an everyday mother. The other half I was learning about homicide investigative techniques and how to spot an arson fire. My grandfather and uncle had been sheriffs in Michigan, and my own years as a policewoman had only enhanced my belief that lawmen were good guys. Nothing I saw as a crime reporter tarnished that image, even though in the early 1970s, police were frequently referred to as pigs. Because in a sense I had become one of them again, I was privy to information on cases being actively worked, as I had been with the Divine homicide. I didn't discuss this information with anyone outside the police world, but I was aware of what was happening in 1974. The year had barely begun when there was a shocking attack on a young woman who lived in a basement room of a big old house at 4325 8th NE near the University of Washington. It happened sometime during the night of January 4th, and it was bizarre enough that Detective Joyce Johnson mentioned it to me. Johnson, with 22 years on the force, dealt with crimes every day that would upset most laymen, but this assault had disturbed her mightily. Joni Lenz, 18, had gone to sleep as usual in her room, a room located in a basement accessible from the outside by a side door that was usually kept locked. When she didn't appear for breakfast the next morning, her housemates assumed she was sleeping in. By mid-afternoon, however, they went down to check on her. Joni didn't respond to their calls. As they approached her bed, they were horrified to see that her face and hair were covered with clotted blood. She was unconscious. Joni Lenz had been beaten with a metal rod wrenched from the bed frame, and when they pulled the covers away, they were stunned to see that the rod had been jammed viciously into her vagina, doing terrible damage to her internal organs. "She's still unconscious," Joyce Johnson told me a week later. "It breaks my heart to see her parents sitting by her bed praying she'll come out of it. Even if she does, the doctors think she'll have permanent brain damage." Joni did beat the odds. She survived, but she had no memory of events from 10 days before the attack until she awoke from her coma, and she was left with brain damage that will stay with her for the rest of her life. She had not been raped, except for the symbolic rape with the bedrod. Someone in the grip of a maniacal rage had found her asleep and vented that anger. Detectives could find no motive at all. The victim was a friendly, shy girl who had no enemies. She had to have been a chance victim, attacked simply because someone who knew she slept alone in her basement room had perhaps seen her through a window, found the basement door unlocked. Joni Lenz was lucky. She lived. She was one of the very few who did.
"Hi, this is Linda with your Cascade Ski Report. Snoqualmie Pass is 29 degrees with snow and ice patches on the road. Stevens Pass is 17 degrees and overcast with packed snow on the roadway."
Thousands of Western Washington radio listeners had heard 21-year-old Linda Ann Healy's voice without really knowing who she was. It was a sexy, sweet voice, the kind of voice that disc jockeys could talk back to, that commuters driving to work at 7 a.m. could enjoy. The last names of the girls who gave the pass reports were never revealed, no matter how many interested men might call in, however. They were anonymous, the vocal personification of the all-American girl. Linda was as beautiful as she sounded, tall, slender, with chestnut hair that fell almost to her waist, clear blue eyes fringed with dark lashes. A senior majoring in psychology at the University of Washington, she shared an older green frame house with four other students. Marty Sands, Jill Hodges, Lorna Moss, and Barbara Little split the rent at 5517 12th NE. Linda had grown up in a sheltered upper-middle-class home in Newport Hills on the east side of Lake Washington from Seattle. Gifted musically, she had played Fiona in Newport High's production of Brigadoon,
and she had been a soloist in the Congregational Church's Winds of God folk mass. But it was psychology, particularly working with retarded youngsters, that interested her most. Certainly in her years at the university, she had had ample opportunity to study the deviant mind. Study, not know. None of the five roommates in the big old house was particularly naive, and they were all cautious young women. Jill's father was the prosecuting attorney in an eastern Washington county, and as a criminal lawyer's daughter, she had been aware of violent crime. But none of the girls had ever been exposed personally to violence. They had read of the attack a few blocks away on January 4th, and they had heard rumors of a prowler in their own neighborhood. They took the proper precautions, locked their doors, went out in pairs after dark, discouraged men who seemed odd. Still, with five of them living in the same house, they felt safe. Linda's job at Northwest Ski Reports meant that she had to get up at 5:30 in the morning and bike over to the office a few blocks away, so she rarely stayed up past midnight. Thursday, January 31st, began routinely for her. She'd recorded the ski report, gone to classes, and then come home to write a letter. She hadn't a problem in the world, other than the fact that her boyfriend worked such long hours that they had little time together, and some vague stomach pains that had been bothering her. She wrote a note to a friend, the last letter she would ever write.
"Just thought I'd drop a line to say hello. It's snowing outside, so I'm writing this letter bundled up in my blue afghan. You wouldn't believe how comfortable it makes studying or napping. Everyone at my house is fine. I've invited Mom and Dad, Bob and Laura, to dinner. I think I'll make beef stroganoff. I've been doing a lot of skiing, some working and studying, not necessarily in that order."
At 2:30 that afternoon, Jill Hodges drove Linda to the university for chorus practice and returned at 5 to pick up Linda and Lorna Moss. They ate dinner, and afterward Linda borrowed Marty Sands's car to go to the grocery store, returning at 8:30. Linda, Lorna, Marty, and a male friend then walked to Dante's, a tavern popular with university students, located at 53rd and Roosevelt Way. The foursome shared two pitchers of beer, and the girls talked to no one, although Lorna and Marty would later recall that their friend Pete had visited briefly with some people who were playing a dice game at a nearby table. They were home in an hour, and Linda received a call from a former boyfriend in Olympia. Her roommates remember that she spoke with him for about an hour. The girls then watched Miss Jane Pittman on television before retiring. When Linda left to go to her basement room, she wore blue jeans, a white blouse, and boots. Barbara Little had been at the library that Thursday evening and went to her room in the basement, a room separated from Linda's by only a thin plywood wall, at 1:45. Linda's light was out, and all was quiet. At 5:30 a.m., Barbara heard Linda's alarm radio go off as usual, and she went back to sleep. At 6, her own alarm sounded, and she was somewhat surprised to hear the insistent buzzing of Linda's alarm still sounding. The phone rang, Linda's employer at the ski report company inquiring why Linda hadn't arrived at work. Barbara went to Linda's room and switched on the light. The room was immaculate, the bed perfectly made without a wrinkle. This was a bit unusual, as Linda's habit was to make her bed after she returned from classes, but Barbara wasn't particularly concerned. She turned off the alarm and assumed that Linda was already on her way to work. Linda Ann Healy was not on her way to work or to school. She was gone without a struggle and without a trace. The green 10-speed bike that Linda routinely used for transportation was still in the basement, but her roommates noted something alarming. The side door which led into the basement was unlocked. They never left it unlocked. Indeed, the door was very difficult, almost impossible, to unlock from the outside, so they always opened it from the inside when they wanted to push their bikes out, and then locked it from the inside again, going around the house to reach their bikes. The single window with its transparent curtain next to the concrete interior steps had long since been painted shut. The girls who lived in the shared home met on campus that afternoon and compared notes. Each assumed that one of the others had seen Linda at classes during the day, yet none had. When her family arrived that evening for the dinner she'd planned, they were frightened. Linda was the last person in the world who would fail to show up for work, class, and most particularly for a supper where she'd invited her family. They called the Seattle police and reported her as a missing person. Detectives Wayne Dorman and Ted Fonis of the homicide unit arrived to talk to Linda's worried parents and housemates. They were led to her neat room in the basement. It was a happy-looking room, painted a sunny yellow, its walls festooned with posters and photographs, many of Linda and friends skiing, several of the retarded youngsters from the experimental school, Camelot House, where the missing girl volunteered her time. Linda's bed was next to the plywood wall. Barbara's was just on the other side. The detectives pulled the spread back. The caseless pillow was stained crimson with dried blood, and a great splotch had soaked through the sheets into the mattress. Whoever had shed that blood would have had to have been seriously injured, perhaps unconscious, but there was not enough blood present to indicate that the victim had bled to death. Lorna and Marty pointed out to the investigators that the bed had been made differently than Linda would have done it.
She always pulled the sheet up over the pillow, and now it's tucked underneath.
Linda had had a pink satin pillowcase on her bed. It was gone. Its mate was in her dresser drawer. Her nightgown was located in the back of the closet, the neck area stiffened with dried blood. A reasonable supposition was that someone had entered Linda's room as she lay sleeping, beaten her into unconsciousness before she could cry out, and carried her away. Her roommates looked through her closet and found the only clothing missing were the jeans, blouse, and boots she'd worn the night before.
"And her backpack is gone," Marty said. "It's red with gray straps. She usually kept books in it and maybe her yellow ski cap and gloves. And yes, she had a whole bunch of tickets to the Youth Symphony and some checks for tickets in there."
Gown had been stained with blood, which surely indicated she'd worn it when she was attacked. The only conclusion the detectives could reach was that her abductor had